This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 6th of July, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch. I'm your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we are broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. The programme's going out on FM radio and also through our internet live stream. And however you're listening, we're also available as a podcast later from the Sheffield Live website. And talking about podcasts, did you catch last week's programme? Because if you didn't, you missed another corker. We had John Holcroft on the programme, and he was talking about how he secured funding from a Tech for Good social accelerator programme, how he's developed, launched, run, and closed a music education app. He was really frank about that, why that worked as a product but failed as a business. And the key point that he missed right at the start, which was the reason it failed. But Holcroft left a well-paid city job writing software for an investment bank to start that app. It closed, but he then got his funding from a Tech for Good social accelerator and has been creating apps to support doctors and nurses and patients in the NHS. And he talked us through his process to test your product or business or social enterprise idea. Now, if you missed the show last week, go to the Sheffield Live website, sheffieldlive.org, find radio shows, look up Business Live, and you'll find the programme from last Friday, and you'll be able to hear the interview with John. Loads of great tips then. But of course, that was then. This is now. Who's on today? Well, I'm delighted that Chris Wright, who's Chief Executive of Catch 22, is here with us, and he's going to tell us all about Catch 22, what he does, what the organisation does in just a few minutes. But before we turn to Chris, what's been going on with you? What's been going on with your business, with your social enterprise? We'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch. You can put yourself forward to be on the show. You can comment about what's going on and how it affects you. Or you can simply ask us what you'd like us to cover in future programmes. All you need to do is email jamie@sheffieldlive.org or send a text to 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Loads of people have ended up on the programme because they got in touch, and we'd love to hear from you. So it's the 70th birthday of the NHS this week, so there's been widespread coverage of that, and more about that later on in the programme. And we have loads of forthcoming events as well. Lots going on this weekend, lots going on next week to support your business or social enterprise. So I'll flag up a few things later on during the programme, both coming up over the weekend and next week and the week ahead. But before we do that, I think it's time to turn to our guest today. And I'm really pleased that Chris Wright is in the studio with us. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. It's great being here.
So, Chris, first of all, can you tell us, simply introduce Catch 22? What does the organisation do?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, Catch 22's got a very modern name, but that we trace our history back to the late 18th century. We were established as the Philanthropic Society in 1788, at the beginning of the Enlightenment. A group of gentlemen would meet in a coffee shop, and they were concerned about the children of felons on the streets of London. 230 years later, we style ourselves as a social business. By governance, we're a charity. We deliver a wide range of public services up and down the country.
Okay, great. So a history you trace back 230 years. That's remarkable. And you deliver services, you deliver contracts all over the country. Tell us about some of those services and some of the work that you're doing there.
Sure. We work across four or five different areas. We style ourselves as a cradle to career organisation. So we run schools primarily for children who are excluded from mainstream schools. So we have a multi-academies trust sits within our group. We have a number of independent schools as well, working with children who are excluded from mainstream. We deliver justice services. So we work in 24 prisons across the country. We run victim support services. We deliver children's social care services such as child sexual exploitation, children who are being criminally exploited, children in need, looked after children. And we also deliver employability and apprenticeship programs.
Right, that's a fairly wide range of services, and the description of sort of cradle through to grave makes a lot of sense there. And these are contracts that you have secured then, that you've won contracts. So who are the people who are commissioning you to do this?
By and large, we're commissioned by government, central government, local government, government agencies. 95% of our revenue is generated through selling our services into public service markets, if you want to use that kind of language. We've been doing that over the last 20, 30 years in particular, but in the last 5 years, our business model has shifted very much towards, as I said, a social business. Up until 2010, much of our work was either soft contracts or grants, and we've had to really pivot our model to an organisation which is competing in some of our environments with big private organisations, as well as with fellow social organisations. We'd rather collaborate and build partnerships than compete, but that's something I can probably talk about in a while.
Yes, I'd love us to come back onto that collaboration rather than compete angle. I think that's going to be really, really interesting. But you just said after 2010, you've moved towards sort of hard contracts. Before 2010, you were more dependent on grants and on soft contracts. So how would you define a soft contract compared with a hard contract?
I think it's the terms and conditions, payment terms. Yeah. So, when you're paid in advance for the work, when it eases the cash flow. But now much of our work is, we're 3 months in arrears. That could mean you end up being paid 120 days after you've delivered the service. That generates real challenges for organisations in our sector, working capital challenges. Obviously, we'd like to have payment terms which are more favourable. Yes. And I think government needs to think very, very hard about how it creates the conditions which allow organisations like ours to be able to participate in these markets. Because if you struggle to access capital, we all know the old maxim, cash is king, and ultimately it brings you down. And indeed, even very large organisations end up being collapsed as a consequence of their cash flow challenges.
Yes, most definitely. And there was widespread opprobrium levelled at Carillion, for example, with Public Accounts Committee criticising them for enforcing 120-day payment terms on their suppliers, who were within their supply chain for contracts that had been outsourced to them. Now, you've just talked about contracting directly with, say, central or local government, but about how your organisation may be subject to 120-day payment terms in effect. And there might be a bit of confusion about this because many listeners will know that the public sector is subject to a requirement to pay people within 30 days. So how do they get away with paying you within 120 days? Tell us a little bit more about those payment models, whether it's PBR, payment by results, or how that...
There's a whole kind of range, I guess, from straightforward payment for services delivered to volume-based contracts where you're paid on the number of people who turn up for the service you're providing, or through to the PBR structures where you're literally paid on the results that you're providing. One of our frustrations is I'm a fan of the principle of payment by results. I think it's sensible that we should be paid by the outcomes. In fact, it'd be great if our public sector colleagues were paid by the results they deliver. But you need to, you can build a payment mechanism, which I think allows government to achieve its objectives and possibly pay some cash in advance, which can be clawed back if you fail on delivery. I think on the standard contracts, one of our frustrations is the ability to negotiate contract terms is almost non-existent. So there'll be clauses in contracts which we'll identify at the negotiation stage, and we'll say, look, actually this clause is really difficult for us, and we'll be given a fairly binary choice. You know, you either accept it or you don't, and more often than not, you know, you end up signing contracts which ultimately are pretty onerous and don't need to be like that. And I don't think it's because there's a actual intent on behalf of government, local government, to make it difficult. I just don't think they understand what it means to have to run a business on cash.
Right. Okay. So it's not necessarily willfully trying to make things harder for people. It's a misunderstanding or ignorance of actually what it takes to run an organisation.
I think I spent, you know, the vast majority of my career in the public sector. I can remember being a commissioner.
Yeah.
And when you're that side of the table, you're really concerned about ensuring public money is well spent.
Yes.
But my understanding of how organisations function out with the state, where, you know, I never had to worry about cash. I never had to worry about whether we'd have enough money in the bank to pay our staff at the end of the month. When you have that visceral appreciation of what it means to run an organisation, it shifts your thinking. And that certainly happened to me 12 years ago when I left the public sector and moved across to this world. I just started to, you know, it was so much I didn't know. I really didn't appreciate what it meant to run a business.
Yep.
And so I'm not being in any way critical of individuals. I just think it's an experience.
Yes.
A deficit of experience, which means people, you know, just don't understand. They're just thinking, well, of course we need to protect the public purse. And what I worry about is that that there is a kind of an undercurrent that we're all venal and we're all trying to game and we're all trying to maximise our own interests. I don't believe that's the truth at all. I think fundamentally people are good, organisations are good, and they want to do good work. I think I think we end up at the lowest common denominator trying to deal with the miscreants who are, you know, few, but the rest of us are dealt with in the same way. And I think we should have a much more relational approach to how we contract, built on reciprocity and trust.
Right, yeah. So there's a lot in there. That's really, really interesting. And I'm going to ask you about your career history and your background and to expand on that in a moment, because the understanding of both sides of the commissioning fence is going to be really, really interesting. But the assumption that business is venal and that people are bad and out for themselves, I mean, there is a widespread perception, and that isn't helped when we hear about the collapse of our outsourcing firms. And then sometimes, of course, MPs in select committees do have a tendency to grandstand to try and make themselves look good when they're criticising. Albeit, though, it's clear that there were widespread problems in terms of the Carillion model of doing business. I picked up last week's Economist. There was a really interesting article about outsourcing in last week's Economist, and it talked about G4S, it talked about Serco, it talked about other well-known names well-known by the public, completely ignored writing about public service delivery by social enterprises. And yet there are social enterprises, Hackney Community Transport, very widely known, turning over something in the region of 25 million, I think.
I think it's double that.
Double that, right. So, yeah. So I'm well out of date there. But and bidding for and against large private sector organisations, winning contracts and delivering them to create great value. So it sort of felt like a massive missed opportunity for the journalists in that publication to not write about this. But when organisations like Hackney Community Transport, they bid for a contract, the commissioner might feel, OK, they're a safe bet. They're large, they're well known, they've been doing it for a while. There's no risk to me. And you talked about sort of being a commissioner and perhaps being commissioners are quite risk averse. Do you think it's simply just easy to award contracts to a name like G4S or Serco and harder to award contracts to a smaller social enterprise? And what do we need to do in terms of making public service contracts available to social enterprises?
I fundamentally think that's right. I think the this is all about perception of how risk is managed. And there's a perception from the Treasury that risk is best managed through large balance sheets. And therefore, we create our own challenges by not properly understanding, not sharing risk properly, not appreciating that these balance sheets can be a house of cards, as we saw with Carillion. Yeah. And I'm not in any way anti the idea of private sector organisations delivering public services. What I'm interested in is how you create a level playing field which allows smaller organisations to be able to participate by just, and this is about, it really is about understanding and appreciating how you manage risk. And of course, government will be concerned about step in. It will be concerned about how, what do we do if organisations fail? But when organisations reach the size of some of these big outsourcers, they're not allowed to fail because the consequences would be absolutely enormous. So, but we then tolerate this kind of a toleration of mediocrity or, the lowest common denominator. And I think we've got to be much more imaginative in how we understand risk and how we understand who's best placed to deliver public services. So I'm a massive advocate of, community organisations, big and small, being much more part of the tapestry of public service delivery. And I take that to, to everything, really. I think the role of a state should be there to enable and facilitate and create the conditions in which people can thrive. But I think the state, much like some of the large outsourcing companies, end up mirroring the state in their size and scale and bureaucracy, and therefore they lack the agility to respond to the needs of their service users. That's where small or more agile social sector organisations can come in and play a role. And I've become very, very strong advocate of the idea of agile decision making, the ability to move quickly, flexibility, which I don't think you see in the large outsourcers, and I don't think you see largely in state-run organisations either.
So we're talking about creating the conditions to allow and to enable smaller and agile organisations to bid for and to deliver successfully public sector contracts, public services. We've talked about, you talked earlier, you have a really interesting soundbite, if you like, or phrase about the difference between a transactional model and a relationship-based model. So how should we be delivering public services? How now in 2018 in post-austerity or continued austerity? Certainly things are very different to pre-2010, as you say. How should we be delivering public services then?
I think we've got to get off the austerity bandwagon. Mm-hmm. I think, of course, money is important. But I think there's a huge amount of capacity and capability in our communities that we fail to tap into.
Yeah.
So we sit on something like £100 billion of charitable trust funds. Are we making sufficient use of not just the investment on those funds, but the capital itself? Can the capital be used differently? We've got, you know, socially responsible businesses and big corporates with their CSR programs, which I think we could think much more imaginatively about how those programs can support the creation of infrastructure and resources on the ground.
Yes.
I think this is the time. This is the moment when this radio station is in many ways a personification of the moment. People wanting to do something, wanting to take back control, wanting to communicate, wanting to be involved in running things. And I think you can extend that to a whole array of services which have been appropriated or taken on by the state. We've got to remember that up until 1945, and this isn't a criticism of Welfare State. I think, of course, it was a really brilliant thing. But 70 years on, you know, as we celebrate the NHS's 70th birthday, I think we should be asking some more fundamental questions about how we can adapt and develop and change. And so it's not just a monolithic bureaucratic structure which drains money, but is much more responsive and able to meet the needs of the people it's there to support. And I mean that more broadly around the welfare state.
Yes, indeed. So you said this radio station, I mean Sheffield Live, volunteers come in every week and create the programmes that they'd love to hear. So it's sort of filling a gap in what is available on radio. So we have someone who's head chef at a hotel who comes in and plays a couple of hours of the music he'd love to hear, and no one else is playing, and people love it. We have a whole range of volunteers coming in playing fantastic music, and that they all love, across genres as well, and talk shows too. And you transplant that model to, as you say, across public service delivery, and you think differently. I mean, I know over the last, say, decade, there have been experiments with things like participatory budgeting and different ways of local democracy. And some people listening to this would say, OK, well, that's all very well, Chris, but we're... And I'm simply perhaps reflecting what some people might say listening to this. We've just had a referendum, and the consequences of that referendum giving a decision to people are tying the government up in knots, whatever you think of the result, pro or anti Brexit. The government is entirely consumed with figuring out how it worked. And some people might say, well, that's sort of, we should have actually left it to the people that we pay to do that. Now, what would you say to that argument?
Well, I mean, one of the consequences of democracy is that you ask the people what they want.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the issue is about recognising that people are active agents and they have ideas and they have views. And I'm interested in how you can mobilise people in communities to be much more involved in doing things for themselves, taking responsibility for what happens to them. And I think one of the consequences of the last 70 years is we've created a culture where there's an expectation that things will be done for us, as opposed to us taking more responsibility ourselves. And I'll tell you a very tragic story to illustrate that. And it might be extreme, but there's just been a serious case review released following the tragic death of a woman in Hackney who died of an epileptic fit in her flat. And her small son was found some weeks later dead alongside her. And the Serious Case Review addressed a number of bureaucratic issues about what the school might have done differently to check on the absence of the child. At no point does it make reference to why didn't the neighbours knock on the door? Why weren't people aware of what was happening in and around them in their own community? And I'm just really interested in the environment we've created where we're not looking out for each other. And so that might sound like it's a long way from the question about the referendum and democracy and participation. But I genuinely believe that if we get people more actively involved in the activities, the delivery of services in and around their communities, we'll end up with a more enlightened, engaged, active citizenship, citizenry. And, you know, I worry that we are denying people agency because of the way our system and structures work and do to people as opposed to do with people. And one of the, just going back to the earlier question around big and small, one of the problems we have around bidding for contracts is that the commission, more often than not, is already determined by the commissioner. So we're told exactly what it is we have to do. So we bid to win work, which is already specified.
Yes.
And my argument is that there will be very little difference in outcome, regardless who wins the contract, because the contracts are so heavily specified.
Yes.
Now, that's because we've got a breakdown in reciprocity and trust, where commissioners should be talking to providers about, and organisations, community organisations, about how best to design services. And then we'll be told, well, it's the procurement rules. Well, it's not the procurement rules. This is about will. It's about creating the conditions that people can be engaged with and use to design solutions to people's problems. Now, there's a lot in that, and but I think all of this is related to the idea that people want to have some influence and some control. And my take on the Brexit result is that take back control resonated so powerfully because it was felt by people, because viscerally they were feeling that they don't have control over what's happening to them. And I think that's true of public service delivery as it is of globalization.
Mm-hmm. So, as you say, a huge amount in there, but you feel there is a massive appetite, actually, for more engagement. You talked about abdicating responsibility rather than taking than being involved in public service delivery and other things that affect us, that affect citizens. You've talked there also about over-specified contracts and contracts being specified, and so whoever actually wins a service wins an invitation to tender to deliver a contract, the outcomes might be very similar, whether it's a social enterprise or a large corporate. The same thing is going to be delivered. Now, one may have perhaps the ability to deliver more social value, but if the service is so overspecified, there isn't much difference. And that's an interesting one, because I know that since 2015 and some changes in the procurement regulations, there's been the ability to use something called an innovation framework. But as far as I know, this hasn't really been used a great deal as yet when designing and commissioning services. But it would give a commissioner the ability to be far more flexible in terms of working with potential providers beforehand and looking at what a service could or should look like.
Yeah. Social Innovation Partnership is a procurement regulation which allows commissioners to procure a strategic partner to design and then deliver innovation. So it just seems to me to be a no-brainer. Why aren't we making use of the regulations in order to bring in more capability so that we can start to utilize that capability to, you know, think differently about what solutions are required, you know, to address many of our, and these, I'm not in any way denying the complexity of the challenges and the problems that we need to confront, but if we have a fundamental belief that there's capacity in our communities, that there's much more knowledge and capability than we're currently accessing, then we've got to find the frameworks which enable that to be unlocked. And I think that's the conversation I'm really interested
yes.
in. And I you know, I'm an agnostic on sector. I'm not some, you know, zealot saying everything's got to be done by the social sector
no.
or everything's got to be done by the public sector or everything's got to be done by the private sector. I think what we've got to do is create the conditions where we can access this huge capability. I keep using that word because I just passionately believe that there's knowledge and resource. You see it every day. I was in Bristol Prison yesterday where we have a contract, and being shown around the prison by one of our colleagues. And she was remarkable in her personal authority and the way she engaged with the prisoners. Now, that was about her. And you know, she works for us and we've got a contract, but it was about her and the strength of her, passion for the work, her personality. Now, I in one individual, you see all this energy and capability, and if we multiplied that, how many people live in Sheffield? Mm-hmm. You know, is it 600,000?
It's around half a million.
Yeah, we're dealing with huge amount of knowledge and enthusiasm and agency. And if we were to find a way of tapping into that, we would be a much better place, I think.
Yes, and moving away from, as we were talking just before, coming into to the studio itself, moving away from a sort of old-school paternalistic view of government, central or local, knowing best and imposing great, wonderful ideas to help people who actually perhaps have far more capacity and knowledge and real life experience than those purporting to sort of make their lives better. yeah, great. So, Chris, loads in there, and I want to ask you more about your own journey as well. I think we're going to take a quick break now for a track of music. Before we do, you're listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme, and we're always interested in your views. Get in touch, send a tweet, Jamie Veitch or Sheffield Live on Twitter. Send a text, 07904 272 200. Send an email, jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Always interested in hearing from you. Loads of people end up on the show because they've got in touch. So don't be shy. Put yourself forward or comment on what we're talking about. Chris Wright is on the programme today. He's the Chief Executive of Catch 22. More from Chris in just a few minutes. But before then, we'll have a track of music by Roy Scopp featuring Suzanne Sunfor. This is Never Ever.
This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for Business Live.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme. And on the show today, Chris Wright, Chief Executive of Catch 22. It's been a fascinating chat so far with Chris. I know it's going to be a fascinating chat for the next few minutes. But before we return to Chris, what's going on this weekend? Well, Sharrow Festival returning for its 21st ever event. Yes, it was set up in 1998, so this is the 21st Sharrow Festival, uniting the community for the free annual event held in Mount Pleasant Park. Well, Sharrow Festival is a fantastic event, and it features live music, including this year a Sheffield Live stage. So come on down, enjoy all the music, enjoy all the community activity, sporting, live graffiti, workshops, children's entertainment, fundraising, festival fringe, loads and loads going on. So should be great fun. And of course, it's at Mount Pleasant Park, just off Aberdale Road. Share a festival tomorrow afternoon. So have fun. Enjoy it. What else is going on? Well, superheroes are going to be in Stores Wood this weekend. Friends of Stoneface Creative and World of Superheroes have teamed up to create a treasure hunt and an exhibition of memorabilia from superhero universes from famous films this weekend. So Andrew Vickers, also known as Stoneface, is hosting a one-of-a-kind superhero event in Stores Wood, which will become home to many famous superheroes, mementos and collectibles from DC and Marvel universes, donated by Sheffield Company, the World of Superheroes. So this is happening on Saturday and Sunday in Stores Woodland in the Loxley Valley. And Stoneface's unique woodland gallery is going to be open to superhero figures alongside Stoneface's work, Andrew Vickers' work. Loads of fun activities, superhero treasure hunt through the woodlands, art trail, superhero collection, refreshments, raffle, treasure hunt prizes. So loads going on. And for more information, go to stonefacecreative.com/events. Now, should you be interested in kicking footballs around or watching people kicking footballs around, then tomorrow might be a big day for you. And if it is, then you could get on down to the Kickoff Festival, because Al Dore, who set up the Russian-themed Soviet Football Festival, came on the show 4 weeks ago to talk about how you can watch the football on the biggest screen in the whole of Sheffield, in Aberdale Cinema on Aberdale Road for free. The festival is free. There are loads of pop-ups. There are loads of there's loads of fun going on. Dressing up, you can dress up as a country, bring your kids, drink craft beer, craft cocktails, get involved in games and fun, and watch the football should you be keen to do so. So that's at Aberdale Picture House. And if you missed Al Dore on the show a few weeks ago, he was fascinating too. So catch the podcast as well. But get on down to the Kickoff immersive Soviet football experience that Al Dore has set up at Aberdale Picture House tomorrow. Plenty going on. Also, loads of events from the Business and IP Centre Sheffield. Free events on copyright, on marketing, social media, much, much more. Check out their website. Plenty to help you and your business or your social enterprise from them. So it's time now to return to our guest of the day, Chris Wright. Welcome back, Chris. It's been really fascinating talking with you today. So we've talked about delivering public services and a different approach. And I want to just ask you briefly about your own career journey. You touched on it earlier, working in the public sector before working in Catch-22, and you lead Catch-22 as the chief exec of this organisation that can trace its own roots back 230 years. But tell me about your journey.
Well, classically, I left university and I didn't really know what I was going to do and ended up flogging advertising space for a bit. And then I decided that the way to change the world was through social work. I genuinely thought that if you could get alongside people, enable people, empower people, then they could take some agency and sort the problems out for themselves. So I thought that's what social work could do. So I ended up training as a social worker. I moved into probation. I then got involved in youth justice and went into government for a period in a quango before heading out into the real world of the voluntary sector, and where I've been for the last 12 years. So, social work. But in a day when I believed social work was all about relationships and community engagement, today I guess social work has been reduced to a bureaucratic risk assessment process, which feels very remote from the needs of people it's supposed to be there to support. That's a very large statement, I appreciate.
Right, that's a fascinating career history as well as a very large statement. But the understanding of social work and what you feel it should be doing, and it can and does do, compared with when it's been put into a sort of tick box culture and overly performance managed. And I suppose you can't blame government for performance managing social work when they're saying, well, you know, we're dealing with vulnerable people. We're dealing with organisations who are meant to, and a sector that's meant to be looking after vulnerable people. And when we get it wrong, when people make an error, the human consequences are absolutely dire. But you presented earlier on today an argument for that we have far more capacity and capability than we often give credit to. So clearly that's driving you now.
Absolutely. I in no way do I underestimate the need to ensure that children and families and vulnerable people are protected. In no way. I just think the way of doing it is different from the way we're structured to do it. And I think my understanding is over the last 70 years, the number of children who have been tragically killed through neglect or harm hasn't really shifted. Yet every time we have a very tragic example, the response of a system is to become more and more, in my view, remote and bureaucratic as it tries to eradicate risk through process and systems.
Yeah.
I think the best way of eradicating risk is by unlocking the potential of individuals. And I think you do that by getting the community much more involved in the way we organise the delivery of these services. So, for example, we've been running a programme in Cheshire, and which we've now taken into Coventry, which is a very modest adaptation to the children's statutory framework. It's a group of children who are designated children in need, Section 17 children. At that point, the system should kick in. Once you've been designated Section 17, the system should kick in and you get allocated a social worker. The reality is, although you may get allocated as a social worker, very little work tends to take place. This is general, in general, because social work time is taken up with the more acute end. Nationally, 45% of children who are designated children in need are re-referred within 12 months. Now, it seems to me that the best thing to do with those children is engage with them at the point they're identified as being in need. But you don't necessarily need to do that through social work or a formal social work, formal social worker. I think you can use other resources in the community to support the family and the children.
Yep.
And the program we've been delivering has had a very significant impact in terms of reducing social work caseloads.
Yep.
Because we're deflecting people away, children and families away at the right point. So it's very modest, but it's a tweak of a regulatory framework. And that's the sort of thing I think we should be starting to think about. How do we just think a bit more imaginatively about changing some of the bureaucratic structures that we've created, and we've created them from a good intent. I'm absolutely clear about that. People, you know, want to do the right thing, but they're worried about it going wrong, and therefore we build these convoluted systems in order to give us confidence that things are going to go right. But I think we should trust people more.
Yeah.
and give people greater, you know, officials and people in the community greater agency to do things and make decisions.
Yeah, okay, grand. Now that brings on to your own approach to leadership within. When you're leading an organisation, you're not only leading employees, and clearly leadership in terms of CEO isn't going to be in your approach about I make the decisions and tell people what to do. But you are the person whose name is attached to that job title. So tell me about how that works for you and how your leadership approach. We've only got a few minutes, by the way, I'm afraid. So I'm going to have to invite you back onto the show because there's more I'd love to cover.
I think, you know, look, leadership is something you never fully grasp. I think you're always struggling to find the best approach to it. I try to lead through believing in people, trusting people. Sometimes you know that goes wrong. The default can be to respond to that by control. I've tried to move in my career from needing to have what appears to be control, but nobody ever can have full control, to an approach which recognises other people's talents. And you can only be good if you surround yourself with really good people. And that's what we try and do.
Right. Grand. Super. And what about inspiration? Who's inspired you? Who does inspire you?
Well, I'm inspired daily by colleagues and people I meet who are social entrepreneurs, who are desperate to change the orthodoxy, the status quo. Brilliant woman who's known in Sheffield, actually, called Charlie Howard, who is a clinical psychologist working in CAMHS, got fed up that actually no young people went to see her in CAMHS, so she went to find where the young people were and ended up creating a new organisation called MAC UK and developed a methodology called Street Therapy. But her intention was for MAC UK to disappear within 10 years,
yes,
because the new approach would become the way of doing things. I really admire that.
Yeah, fantastic. Super. Now, I think you've talked probably quite a bit about what might frustrate you, because we've talked about how public service delivery is stuck in an old-fashioned approach. But is there anything else you'd like to say that frustrates you?
I think my biggest frustration is the way it sounds a bit... I'm trying to find a way of articulating it, but I call it the orthodoxy. Who are the status quo? How it's very powerful in maintaining its grasp on things.
Yep.
And that frustrates me, because I think if we could be more open to ideas and thinking and people and this stuff I've been talking about, you know, then I think a lot of our problems would be much more we'd find solutions much more readily.
Right. Okay. So being open and open-minded and not stuck in a sort of, well, we've always done it this way, so that's why we'll always do it.
Yeah. Yep. Do okay. Different.
Do different. Great. Future goals then for you, for Catch 22. If we were interviewing you in a year's time and you were saying, well, it's been a brilliant year because.
Well, gosh, you know, I think we last year we reorganized Catch 22 to focus on something called our end game. I read a really interesting paper from the Stanford Innovation Review called What's Your End Game? And it set out a set of different end games, one of which was something called government adoption. And what we've interpreted that to mean is that eventually you persuade government to adopt a way of doing things based on evidence, which then becomes the way of doing things, and it infects the public policy DNA. So for us, a measure of whether we've achieved anything will be, have we managed to persuade government to adopt some of our thinking around one of our particular ideas?
Grand. And then that is a brilliant note to end on. So great. Chris, thank you so much for coming in and talking about Catch 22. Now I'm going to give you the opportunity to give the website address out.
Okay, it's catch-22.org.uk.
Superb. Chris Wright, Chief Executive, Catch 22. It's been thoroughly interesting speaking with you today. Thank you for taking the time to come into Sheffield Live.
Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to Business Live on Sheffield Live, our weekly business and social enterprise program. Get in touch, email jamie@sheffieldlive.org, send a text 07904 272 200, find us on Twitter. We'll be back on air next Friday, but don't go away now, because next up on Sheffield Live, our fantastic folk music program, Thank Goodness It's Folk, from 10 all the way through to noon. So stay tuned for that, and come on down to the Sharrow Festival this weekend. Meet up with loads of Sheffield Live DJs, volunteers. Get involved, enjoy the music, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our guest, Chris Wright. Thanks also, Sangeeta in the studio as sound engineer. We'll be back on air next Friday. We'll play out with a bit of Sister Sparrow and the Dirty Birds. This is Borderline.
This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.